Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is March 5th, 2015. Tremendous amount of material to cover tonight. A few quick announcements. You've probably seen this in the news. A 12 billion, alleged 12 billion year old black hole supposedly discovered. And now, how did they discover these? Well, they believe that quasars are objects at the far edge of the universe based on the redshift. Now, this had a redshift of 0.63, which puts it up in the top, probably dozen high redshift objects. Now, the whole point is here that then they convert that redshift into an age, assuming that this stuff has been flying apart or away from us since the beginning of the alleged Big Bang. And they're stating that this occurred, this light we're seeing occurred only 900 million years after the alleged Big Bang. So what's the problem here? Well, the problem is that the redshift has nothing to do with distance or anything else. It's simply a property of the star itself. I've explained this. It's called the induced electric dipole redshift. You will find this published in my early work. And obviously, even back then, the whole concept of redshift had to be explained. And so, to go along with this particular announcement that's been raging in the news media, first of all, it's just sad that, first of all, the news media picks up on this and just repeats it. That's one issue. But one thing I wanted to say is I'm very proud of the public, and I believe there's some of my followers, students, whatever you might want to call them, out there, and they just slammed this author. I believe it was on CNN, the Candy Nugget News, where the article appeared. But they just tore into him. And it's just great to see the public becoming scientifically savvy. They're not buying this phony baloney, black hole, dark matter, all of this anymore. So at any rate, I'm going to do a little narration in a while about some attacks that have been going on about me, just to keep up with that. But my name had been removed from Wikipedia, not that they said anything great about me anyway, but they found it better just to remove my name completely. And one of the main reasons was because they claimed I made unsubstantiated claims. And they didn't say what those unsubstantiated claims were or how they determined that they were false. These are the thought police out there who go through Wikipedia and other locations on the Internet, cleaning it up for your savory consumption. But at any rate, talking about unsubstantiated material now, so I went to Wikipedia and I typed in unsubstantiated material, and that's what I actually searched on, just to see what on Wikipedia was unsubstantiated, and lo and behold, up comes dark matter. So this is funny. Wikipedia censors James McCanny because they claim I have unsubstantiated claims that my science is based on or something like that. But they have a huge write-up on dark matter. And so let me just read what it says. Dark matter is a hypothetical kind of matter. Wow, let's just stop right there. It's a hypothetical kind of matter, but it's not just some hypothetical kind of matter. It's the entire basis of modern standard science fairy tale cosmology, the Big Bang, black holes, dark matter, the theory that they have for how galaxies form, their ability or alleged ability to explain the red-blue shift data, what's called the light curve data from galaxies, the movement of stars in the arms of galaxies. They have to invent dark matter to make the theories work. And so let me read this. This is just almost comical. It says, dark matter is a hypothetical kind of matter that cannot be seen with telescopes, but accounts for most of the matter in the universe. The existence and properties of dark matter are inferred. Mind you, they're inferred, not measured. Let me see. Science is a precipice on which facts are built by scientific experimentation. I think that started with Galileo. Apparently that's been set by the wayside. I believe now popular vote in who's getting grant money from the government weighs in as to the so-called correctness of astrophysical theory. And so they're talking about gravitational effects on visible matter, radiation, the large-scale structure of the universe. It says it has not been detected directly, making it one of the greatest mysteries in modern astrophysics. So isn't that special? By the way, if you hear some noise in the background, I'm currently in the route traveling, and I don't have my nice, lovely, quiet home studio that I normally do my show in, the best conditions all the time. Okay, I'm going to keep reading this because it just is so bizarre. I think this is funny. It says, dark matter neither emits nor absorbs light. Let me see. You have 95% of the universe matter that doesn't absorb any light. Yet it's there in such quantities and density that you can't see it, but supposedly it doesn't absorb any light or any other electromagnetic radiation at any significant level. The standard model of cosmology, the total mass energy of the known universe contains 4.9% ordinary matter, 26.8% dark matter. Now, how do they come up with this 0.8? That's what I really want to know, 26.8. And you know, I want to know the guy that figured that 0.8 part out. You know, round it up to 27, maybe. You know, but come on, 26.8? Give me a break, buddy. And then it says 68.3% dark energy. Now, this is something, too. It says that dark matter is estimated to constitute 84.5% of the matter of the universe, while dark energy plus dark matter constitute 95.1% of the total mass energy content of the universe. Astrophysicists hypothesize dark matter because of discrepancies between the mass of large astronomical objects determined from their gravitational effects and the mass calculated from these observable matter, stars, gas, dust, that they can be seen, etc., and goes on with a bunch more gibberish. But this is just beyond comical. I mean, they can't tell you what the properties are. It supposedly doesn't absorb light. It doesn't interact with anything, but it supposedly acts gravitationally, but in no other way. They can't see it. They can't define what properties it has. They can't define any laboratory experiments that would give you an inkling that it even exists. But it's used to patch up astronomical, astrophysics, cosmological theories that don't add up. That's the entire purpose of dark matter. Anyway, I'm not going to waste any more show time on that. And so anyway, this is just comical because now Wikipedia specifically says that this is speculative, unsubstantiated, but it's the basis of all of modern cosmology, and they put it in there in Wikipedia. Now, by their very own standards, shouldn't this be eliminated from Wikipedia? Are we dealing with a full deck of cards here, folks? Okay, not going to waste any more time on that. Just a quick comment. The Russian craters are back in the news again. These holes in the ground in Russia, they're just like a perfectly cylindrical hole in the ground. They might be a couple hundred feet. They might be less. They might be shallower. But the top is just completely blown off of these, and matter is scattered out, and then it's mushroomed out at the sides, kind of like a mushroom that's kind of exploded out, or a loaf of bread that when it bakes, it kind of breaks open at the top and it expands out. But these, you can see pictures of these on the internet. But they have now, I think it's in the hundreds of these that have been discovered. At the time when I first talked about this a couple months ago, they had three. The first one was discovered, and then they found two more. Now they're up to the hundreds of these discovered around in Siberia in Russia. People started looking into this. And, of course, the first explanation from Standard Fairy Tale Science came out that, oh, it's global warming. Global warming. What an amazing concept. That somehow global warming caused the ground to explode. Well, no. What my explanation was, if you remember, it was, and this is in the gas, the natural gas fields of Russia up in Siberia, and these form pockets of gas. So, gee, what a great surprise. But at any rate, when lightning hits, now that's the James McCanney explanation, is when lightning hits, it ignites the methane gas that is building up in these chambers and Kahui. It's not global warming or some mild explanation, but they got to get that global warming in there. That's, of course, while talking about that, a senator this past week went on the floor of the House and brought a snowball in from side, and he says, you know, guys, it's really, really, really cold out there, even as this is Washington, D.C., very cold, and it's setting records. In fact, this past week has been record-setting temperatures, low temperatures, all over the country, all over the world, in fact, and they keep pumping, promoting this concept of global warming. So at any rate, but in response to that, a Senator Whitehouse got up, and he's one of the big proponents that we're all going to die from global warming very soon, and gets up and does a rebuttal about the guy bringing a snowball into the congressional chamber. And then Obama adds to that. Of course, he's one of the top scientists in the country, as I've heard. what a joke. What a bunch of morons. In his little Obama's comment is, no greater threat to future than climate change. I get a break. Well, the court is simply about control of the public. That's all it is. This was an interesting story. The CIA tried to infiltrate Venezuela this past week with one of its very typical, sending in a guy under guise of an airline pilot, and with a lot of materials to incite an insurrection in the government in Venezuela. So Venezuela then responded, name-calling Obama, and of course they know who he is. He's the middle management of the World Bank, but represents the United States. So, of course, they use his name to talk about the imperialist United States, calling for war crime investigations of the United States. And, of course, the U.S. House and Senate retaliate by putting sanctions on Venezuela. And it's like they don't even care. It's like they don't trade with the United States. They don't care. And the reality is for people, the poor people who live in Venezuela, they're just very happy to have medicine, medical attention, dental attention, some of them for the first time in their life, education, etc. And that's what they get. And they realize that by working, and at this point they are working collectively, of course, that's the only way out of this. And so they realize. But the whole point of this is that Venezuela has an election coming up in a couple of weeks here. And the U.S., just like they do all over the world, are in there inciting chaos, if you might call it that. Anyway, just to keep that up. Now, as long as I'm on this topic of the CIA, the police force of the World Bank, the Google, and this I'm going to read some, this was sent in by a listener, and of course when listeners send things in, I go and verify them. But the thought police are very alive and well on the internet. The thought police. They are out there cleaning up the information on the on the internet to cleanse it for public consumption. And so here's what's going on. They are, let me just pull up this email here and read some of it. The article comes from, it says, by John Rappaport, one of my favorite authors who covers many of these topics. It says, Google gives new meaning to Orwellian, becomes Ministry of Truth. And the first thing he quotes is from George Orwell. It says, if all records told the same tale, then the lie passed into history and became truth. That's George Orwell in his book 1984. Okay, this is an article in New Scientist, which is, of course, the government mouthpiece, rah-rah, NASA, etc. This occurred February 28, 2015. Google wants to rank websites based on facts and their truth factor, not on the links. And the number of links or the number of hits or popularity of the site, which was the original idea of Google. They want to determine the truth level of a website, and that's how they want to rank it. And so that comes down to the basic question, who decides what is truth? In an open, free in society, a lot of times we don't like to hear what other people have to say, but it's a way of, for example, people badmouth me. Well, when people read that and then they read what they realize that what they're saying about me is false, then they become the object of people's disdain. And of course, it's silent because there's no way to get feedback on most of these sites. There's no blog or feedback allowed. But at any rate, this has been going on for some time, and it's now becoming public. So when they make it public, that means it's already done. They're saying that they then have a table. Let me see where the name of this table. Well, first of all, they talk about, for example, anti-vaccination websites, that those will be one of the targets to be a non-truthful website. And by the way, the whole issue of vaccination is really coming to a head. It's really a polarized issue, with the main promoters of this coming from the government, from Big Pharma, from the companies that build the shots, the vaccinations that everybody's supposedly supposed to take. But here, Jimmy Kimmel and these Hollywood paid comedians, you know, night show people, are slamming parents who do not get their kids vaccinated. And the simple logic is, if the shots work and you get your kids vaccinated, then what's the problem? They're safe, aren't they? you're depending on that. You're putting your faith in that vaccine, and it's, you want everybody to get it because it sure works, right? But if your kids have it, then there shouldn't be any problem at all, is the basic idea. And so, anyway, that's one of the issues that the Google thought police. But they're saying that the website truthfulness would be tested by the knowledge-based trust score. And this would be by tapping into the knowledge vault. This was a truth vault that is designated by Google, then kept for them. So by creating a truth, many, many corroborating truth sites with the same story, they would then be able to dominate what you would be allowed to read on the internet. Along this same vein, about 3 months ago, there became a barrage of what is now visibly a very well-organized smear campaign against my work and my good name. And, of course, they start out with calling me a crank or a crackpot or a pseudoscientist, all the typical names. But here's the basic issue here. I am becoming extremely successful. I've been successful for decades now. But my message in reaching the public has hit fever pitch, really has. And I get the feedback, I know this. I'm not a person with a big ego. It's not like I need my ego stroked. I have plenty of success in my life, in my own work, my public side, in the teaching I've done at the university level, 10 years plus of teaching math, astronomy, physics, and computer science at the university level, 25 years of working in the telecommunications industry as a 10 of those years as a high-level design engineer in hardware and software. So I have many successes, the solving the prime number problem, calculating directly prime numbers. There's many, not to mention all the space science discoveries that I've made, theoretical work, etc. But, you know, it's not like, and I have so much more to do, so very much more to do than many things I'm working on in the background. But it's clear that my success is aggravating some people. And so it's very strange to see. But recently, a little joker that, now this is the voice of the guy, Science at NASA. Now I've played some of these ridiculous YouTube videos on my radio show in explaining how ridiculous they are, but the voice of Science at NASA, this little joker, now has started to attack Jim McCaney. And I thought to myself, now, doesn't he have enough super discoveries at NASA to keep him more than busy announcing all of the amazing NASA new discoveries, etc.? what's he doing attacking me? A couple examples of false information. He goes, well, I've never read any of McCaney's books, but he says electric universe, so he must mean that everything is dominated by electricity in the universe. And I don't say that at all. So this little twerp doesn't know anything about me, has never read my books, has sketched a couple times at my webpage. And clearly somebody is writing this script for him. And so anyway, it's clearly the voice of the little twerp. He's got kind of this, gee kids, isn't NASA great kind of voice. Pseudo-intellectual, the kind you hear on public radio, National Public Radio or something. But at any rate, what is clear here is that there's a tremendous organized effort to slam my name. And there's all kinds of other web pages out there, Rational, Wiki, and all of these that have been developed to slam stuff. And, of course, many of the topics and people that they cover on these pages are government-supported. They create a lot of nutcase people out there with little egos running around, and they support these people so they can create a lot of crazy Planet X stories. And then they can point them and mix me with those. The reality is I've always worked alone. Just many examples, just a scientific example, is that this little yoker from Science at NASA says that I don't know about charge exchange. I invented the topic of X-rays and comets. It's in my very earliest work. You can read it in the appendix of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, where it reprints my papers from the 1970s, where I discuss X-rays and comets and give the reasoning for it. It's the electron beam to the sunward side of the comet nucleus, and that's exactly where they were discovered. NASA comes up, and Tom Craven, I know him, and Carrie Liss, I've been side to side by them at American Geophysical Union meetings with my posters and their posters and discussing this. So I know these people personally. They don't like me, but, you know, life in the big city. But this little twerp says that I don't know anything about this. Well, this little joker doesn't know anything about me. He's never met me, never talked to me, doesn't know anything about my history, but he's out there making bizarre little claims. But see, that doesn't matter to them. What matters is that they have a little hour presentation slamming James McCaney. But, okay, so it's also good advertisement because I just got an email from a guy. That's how he found out about my webpage, is by those, the bad-mouthing of me webpages. this guy found my webpage and is very excited to be learning my material. So there's some positive benefits to all of this. But the point is that I've learned that NASA is understanding they're losing credibility. That Big Bang article, the 12-billion-year-old black hole, is a perfect example. The people just jumped on this author on CNN and just cremated him in his own article in the blog below. And they allowed these statements to stay in there. And, of course, they have their little troll, internet troll, government-paid troll to be on there to try and goody-two-shoe for the government. For the NASA baloney. But the point is, I'm becoming far too successful. And the public don't believe anything NASA says, especially their theoretical baloney. So the only thing they can do is steal my work. But before they do that, they first got to discredit me. So that's what's going on right now. NASA, and it's already happened. Here's an article right here that Venus has atmosphere acts like a comet. This is out of science.com. Okay, but here's this little joker. When I say that Venus acts like a comet, then Jim McCanney is wrong. But when NASA says Venus atmosphere acts like a comet, gee, they're right. What's the difference? Anyway, I'm not going to go into a lot of this, but it's clear that NASA is poising to try and take over my material before they did it by a tactic called a creeping crud, where they take a piece here or a piece there. But they have to make an all-out assault on my information. Let me just talk about another guy, Velikovsky. Had some many great discoveries, and one of them was the rapid evolutionary changes in biological genetics. And he first discovered this with bomb craters during World War II. He would examine the plants around the crater, and they would be modified just a little bit from the plants that grew there before. And so he realized that severe stress, would change the genetics of a plant. And then he, of course, inferred that with humans and other types of biological life. It was a tremendous discovery. Stephen Jay Gould then rewrote this and won tremendous prizes for it. But hey, Stephen Jay Gould was one of the guys that was with Sagan to badmouth Velikovsky. Isn't that nice? First you destroy the guy, badmouth him, call him a lunatic fringe, then you steal his ideal and win a prize. You know, a major scientific discovery attributed to Stephen Jay Gould that belongs to Velikovsky. Anyway, that's the way it works out there, because good ideas are very thin and far between. And like I say, NASA is having a harder time every day convincing people of its dirty snowball comet model and all of this. Nobody believes that. Good grief. What third grader would even consider that for less than a New York second? Oh, just a little note also. What's funny about the little science at NASA guy, he doesn't criticize any of the so-called electric universe people who are supported by NASA, who steal my material and pretend like they're jumping up and down little scientists on the internet that don't have any degrees of any kind at all, that get a picture from NASA every day, formatted and with an explanation so they can post it on their webpage, plus a lot of under-the-table money. This little twerp doesn't say anything bad about them. Isn't that special? So we can kind of see where all this is going. Someone is in charge of all of this. And, gee, do you think this guy is just doing this out of the goodness of his heart because he's interested in it? Nah, he's getting paid. Where does Phil Plait get his money? He doesn't have any visible source of income. Last time I heard, running a blog is not one of your top income-gathering employment ventures in the world. So who's buttering Phil Plait's bread under the table? You know, come on, boys and girls. Okay, I'm going to get off this topic. But it's real important to understand this goes along with the CIA, Google, cleansing of knowledge. And so they're moving it into the truth tables. The truth standard, where they have a truth knowledge bank. long time ago, they came up with the idea of knowledge-based systems, or expert systems, they were called, in which you would get all the experts of the world, and if you could get all of their expert information on the internet, then gee, you would contain and have captured all of the true information. Wouldn't that be swell? The only problem is, about 99.9% of everything that has been taught at the college, the K-12, everything from kindergarten to K-12 to university to PhD level, especially in the scientists, is pure garbage. And of course, differentiate that. They like to hide behind this shield that there is some very good sound science in physics, your basic physics courses, electromagnetism, etc. You know, basic physics, modern physics, thermodynamics. There's many there's a tremendous amount of very solid physics. But see, then you branch off into these kind of nebulous theories of space science, and they rely on that idea that physics is sound, therefore all of these hodgepodge, I call them the axioms of astronomy, are somehow true, and then the interpretation of data from space probes all have to fit into that mold. And it's just not the case. And so it's important. I'm not dwelling on this because I feel bad about somebody attacking me. It's actually a compliment. The amount of effort they're putting into trying to destroy my name is a credit to my success. I'm becoming wildly successful. And so they don't like that. They don't like that. And so, but the point is, this whole idea of knowledge police and thought police and the internet and cleansing and slamming people, or, you know, the whole idea of conspiracy theory, or the fact that the government puts a lot of time and money into false information, both nutcases out there and in phony fairy tale tier 2 science. They put a tremendous amount of effort. So this is an educational process. I'm not going to go out and cure it. I just want you to understand, and especially kids, man, you being exposed to misinformation today that didn't even have a thought of existing when I was a kid. So you got a lot more to deal with than I ever did. Of course, that misinformation was there. It's just that nobody knew about it back then. A couple quick scientific announcements. Ceres is a minor planet. It exists between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter. It's about 600 miles in diameter, a spherical minor planet. It's the biggest of the asteroids, so I guess they categorize this as an asteroid. I wouldn't. I would call it a individual planet. It's spherical, and that's my definition of a planet. If the object has created enough heat in its formation process to be spherical or close to spherical, then that, to me, constitutes a planet. Now, you take something little like the nucleus of Halley's Comet or Comet Borley or the Comet P67, the one they're visiting from the Rosetta Space Station, spacecraft visiting a comet, etc. I wouldn't consider those planets. I would consider them asteroids or comet nuclei, etc. And there's a very much a cross there. They're pretty much the same thing, because anything that discharges the solar capacitor literally is a comet. So by that definition, Earth is a comet, Venus is a comet, Pluto is a comet, Jupiter is a comet, the big moons of Jupiter are a comet, and all the little moons too. Okay, so Ceres is a comet, but it's a planet-looking type of object. They claim they have discovered, and these are pre-announcements, that they've discovered water on its surface. Well, of course, if it has water on its surface, how does water exist? Because the sun, through the process of sublimation, should have baked that off 4.5 billion years ago. So how on Earth does water exist on the surface of Ceres, this small planet? Well, the answer is that there are the moons, the icy moons of Jupiter. There are many icy objects in the solar system, and they don't exhibit comet properties of any kind in terms of the Dirty Snowball Comet model. And so they exhibit plasma discharge comet model properties all the time. But at any rate, don't tell that to anybody at NASA. They are sound asleep over there. But Ceres, it's going to be nice to see these pretty pictures that we're going to be bequeathed as a result of this. But something that I've noticed recently with the thought police out there vigorously cleaning up the internet is that there's no high quality photos out there. Anything above, say 100 kilobits or kilobytes in terms of a picture, and something that you could use as a small window photo on your computer, there's no high-resolution data anymore. They've cleaned it all up. In other words, you can find some pretty pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope, but that's it. And there's a NASA website where you can print some posters in, like, for your bedroom wall, just so that when you go to your room at night, you just remind your parents, remember to send the money to NASA, because they were nice enough to give me this pretty picture on my wall. But that's it. Kids don't have the results of our space program, certainly not data. But anyway, that's all we're going to get out of this Ceres project. And in the background, of course, Tier 1 science is lifting all the real data out there, letting the garbage data pawn off on the Tier 2 scientists, and that's what you're going to end up seeing. Record cold, I wanted to just reiterate that, record cold this past week again throughout the country. This is getting very old, and I know a lot of people out there are very tired of this, but we are in a very cold period, and it's now that we're moving into springtime, well, we'll see. It's always difficult to predict. We've been lucky to come out of harvest with moderately sufficient food. But, of course, this is not being announced. The real problem with food production is that the worldwide food production is being cut dramatically. Just another quick comment. Israel is joining the commercial space ventures, putting about, I forget how many billions of dollars over the past 3 years into this program to convert their military program into commercialization of space. So that would be satellites, communication, possibly a manned flight, although they're not really talking about that specifically. I think they're talking more about commercializing the telecommunications and possibly visual aspects of outer space, telemetry, it's called, which includes photographs, etc. So, okay, on to tonight's main science topic. And I just want to reiterate, for weeks I've been talking about shielding and the fact that electrical effects are very subtle and that gravity is the primary mover and shaker in the universe, and it really is. My model for galactic production is very much based on gravity. And there are electrical effects, but the electrical effects are subtle and have to be put into context. And that's why it's very strange to have somebody attacking me on the internet saying that I think everything in the universe is caused by electricity. I've never, ever said that. And so it's very bizarre. But there again, these are not scientists. These are little mouthpieces out there jabbering. Where are the real NASA scientists? You got to remember that I debated a real NASA scientist, a Tier 2 NASA scientist, albeit David Morrison. Dr. David Morrison is one of the top, considered one of the top scientists at NASA, but of course he's Tier 2, not Tier 1. And I debated him on the Coast to Coast AM show and won the debate, dealing with my work, the electric nature of the universe, etc. And so I think the end result, with all the billions and billions of dollars spent by NASA, I win the debate. So clearly something is haywire in their story. But at any rate, it's very strange to have somebody who's a non-scientist that has no scientific background lying about what I'm saying and then trying to prove me wrong. It's weird. Let's put it that way. In conjunction with a much bigger program. Okay, well, I'm not going to dwell on that. But in past weeks, I have been stressing the fact that shielding, both magnetic shielding and electric shielding, occur in the universe. I believe it's still up there. I've been very busy this past week with personal things that I'm doing in the background. So I haven't changed the photo on my webpage. It's still there. It has the Holmes, Comet Holmes there with this giant, larger than the sun shield, electrical shield around it. Very beautiful example of electrical shielding in outer space. So at any rate, this week I want to talk about magnetic shielding. I just happened to be online for a few minutes and Dr. Bill Deagle called up. I'm a guest on his show now and then. But the question came up about magnetic fields. And so I went into a short tirade about the five-layer magnetic field structure that I designed for Earth's magnetic field. Okay, so dealing with shielding magnetically. Now, let me just go through the five-layer Earth magnetic field model. This is in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. The Earth's magnetic field is said to start in its core. And that's because they can't imagine anything else. There's really no evidence that there are just circulating electrical currents in the core of the Earth. The reason is because there's no battery in there. For circular currents to continue, you have to have some kind of battery source. Nobody has ever been able to identify this. And electrical currents have one basic principle. If you don't have an ongoing source of battery, they don't continue forever. They're not magical. They don't just happen to be there magically. And that's one of the great errors of modern astrophysics, astronomy, space science theory, is they always interpret what they observe in outer space in terms of magnetic fields, not understanding that the underlying principles are dealing with electric fields. And with electric fields, you have electric currents. Those electric currents cause the magnetic fields, and it goes in that direction. That's the way it works. Okay, so at any rate, looking at Earth's magnetic field, when you are standing on the Earth holding a compass, like a Boy Scout compass in your hand, or a Girl Scout compass, they work the same way, the needle is a magnetic material. It's people use the term magnetized, but basically it aligns, the field of that magnetic field aligns with the magnetic field of Earth. That's a very good example of shielding, that magnetic fields like to align. That's a way of connecting magnetic fields. Okay, now, this is solid material in the surface of planet Earth, in the mantle and in the crust. When iron or nickel, those are the two primary metals that contain magnetic fields, there are other type of more exotic materials that are hold of a good magnetic field, but they're all the same in one respect. When you create a permanent magnet, here's what you do. You take some iron or you take some nickel or a combination of magnetizable materials. You put it in a form like a molten lead comes in, etc. And it doesn't simply form a magnetic field by itself. You have to have it immersed in an external magnetic field. And that magnetic field externally has to be maintained by some type of power source, and it has to be there for the entire cooling period of the metal, of the iron or nickel or whatever you have. And the stronger the external magnetic field during this cooling process, the stronger your permanent magnet will be, because it's aligning, it's causing all of the little magnetic fields on the atomic level to line up. And if you have a weak magnetic field, they're going to be moving around and not aligning very well. So the stronger your magnetic field, external magnetic field, the stronger your permanent magnet will be once it solidifies. Now, there's a temperature. It's called the Curie temperature. And it is the temperature at which the magnetic field of the little individual atoms is locked into the solid as it cools. It's called the Curie temperature. This is the way it works. So if you have a permanent magnetic field in the Earth, in the crust of the mantle, in the material that's solidified there, it had to have, during that whole cooling period, it had to have been immersed in an external powered by some source, magnetic field, and during that entire period of time as the metal was solidifying in the geological case, that is a very long time. It could be 1,000 years. It could be longer. And so this permanent external magnetic field has to be there and consistently in the same direction. Okay, so this is another great example of shielding, that you are concentrating a magnetic field in a solid piece of material. As it cools, it locks in that magnetic field, so to speak. And, okay, when it cools, you pick it up. Now you have a permanent magnet. And these are used in electric motors and any type of electrical generator has permanent magnets, and they use them in kids' toys, etc., etc. So, okay, that's in the surface of the Earth. So the Earth itself had to be immersed in a completely externally powered magnetic field for that entire cooling period. Around that is in the atmosphere, we have the jet streams. The positively charged jet streams in the northern and the southern hemisphere move easterly, and they kind of snake north and south as they move in an easterly direction. That positive charge, you will find, is coupled with the north-facing magnetic field that is locked in the permanent magnetic field metals in the Earth's crust, in the mantle. Okay, so then you have an equatorial electron belt around the equator of the Earth, which flows westerly. And so the electrons flowing to the left, if you're looking for the view from the north is to the top, the electrons flowing westerly, the ion belts flowing easterly, they are coupled together. And so this is the way magnets shield each other, in a sense. It's a type of coupling, and that's the same thing that when I was talking last week about the fact that a comet nucleus, if you're off to the side and the nucleus is charged, you will not see it because it's surrounded by a shielding, a Debye shield. It's an electrical shielding, and you literally will not be able to see the electric charge. You'll probably hear some electrical noise coming through, but even that will be blocked to a degree, and our own ionosphere is great at blocking electromagnetic signals from leaving, because they, like this show that you're listening to tonight, if you're listening on shortwave, the radio beam is beaming between the ionosphere and the ground and bouncing around the Earth. That's a perfect example of electrical shielding. It's containing that radio signal so it can bounce around the Earth and get to your radio. Okay, so now we've gone through the permanent magnetic field in the Earth's surface. It's coupled to the jet streams, which are ionized, moving eastward, electrons moving westerly around the equator. And then let's go up to the ionosphere. The ionosphere is a capacitor positively charged with respect to the negatively charged Earth. And now this, once again, you have to understand where this is. Above the equator, you have a westerly moving electron belt, or above the northern and southern hemispheres, you have easterly moving positive current. And that's coupled with the ionosphere. On a visual notice, if you look at the planet Jupiter, it has many bands of counter-rotating they're rotating to a degree less than others, so they're basically counter-rotating in the frame of reference of Jupiter. But they're the same thing, counter-rotating electrically positive belts and electrically negative rotating in the other direction, and they couple together to help power Jupiter's very strong magnetic field. The Earth does the same thing. The Sun is doing the same thing. Saturn is doing the same thing. Because remember, Jupiter doesn't have a significant core metal base to produce its amazing, unbelievably huge magnetic field. It's all plasma. It's all electrical gases that are moving. And okay, so let's go out one more layer from the Earth to the Van Allen belts. These are layers, primarily electrons, but there's layers of positively charged ions also moving in the other direction. These are locked. They are locked into an orbit around Earth, and this is a basic physics problem. What is the Van Allen radial radius, the radius of orbit of an object like an electron, a negatively charged electron, moving in orbit around the Earth? And what's the magnetic field strength of Earth? And then what is the orbital radius of that electron? And you can determine from the Van Allen belts, first of all, based on the energy of the electrons, you can determine their orbital radius. Because in a magnetic field, an electron or a positively charged ion would move perpendicular to the direction of the magnetic field. It's called the right-hand rule. You can learn about that. Introductory physics book would talk about that. But at any rate, remember I talked a bit about the Van Allen belts last week and a study done at MIT. That's in last week's show. Now let's move out from the Van Allen belts to the next layer, which is the geomagnetic plasma field. This is a magnetic field in which gas ions, basically positively and negatively charged ions, form another final sheath around the Earth. And this is in the noseward side of the Earth. It's about 30,000 miles out. NASA for many years has had satellites exploring this region, and much farther out, not a lot farther out, but in that region is where it blocks the solar wind. How does a magnetic field block the solar wind? Well, the positively charged protons come in, hit the magnetic field, and they bend one way and move around, and the electrons come in, hit that same magnetic field and bend the other way. And so it's a way of blocking the solar magnetic field. Also coupling with it, but blocking, I'm sorry, not the solar magnetic field, but the solar wind of charged particles coming at Earth. And so all of this is driving now the flow, the solar wind flow of electrons around one side and the positive charge around the other side is another source of magnetic field. And in my weather book, I also enumerate 17 different batteries that are formed. This is all in the plasma, so I'm not going to repeat that on this show. But, okay, so you starting at the top layer out, you have the solar magnetic field, which is locked in the solar wind. And by the way, many times the solar magnetic field in the solar wind is oppositely directed from the magnetic field that we have on Earth with the pole pointing towards the north. The north pole of the magnet is also what we call the geomagnetic north pole of Earth. And they somewhat coincide, although the migrating north pole, magnetic north pole, is a whole different, is a whole separate issue. But so that the starting from the sunward side in, you have the solar wind splitting, that's the outer layer magnetic field. You have the geomagnetic field of positive and negatively charged ions, which is out very far, like 30,000 miles from the surface of the Earth. You have the next layer in is the Van Allen belts. The next layer in is the ionospheric electrical currents counter-rotating. The next layer in is the jet streams. And the next layer in is the permanent magnet that is locked in Earth's magnetic field in your locality. Okay, so now talking about magnetic shielding. This is a wonderful example of magnetic shielding. When we used to do experiments in the laboratory, one of my senior projects that I did my senior thesis on was on something called Auger electrons. And so it was in a vacuum bell brought down to near state of vacuum in outer space, a very low vacuum, and then you'd fire electrons, a beam of electrons, at a crystal. I believe we used molybdenum and tungsten crystals. And with the electrons acting and as the wave nature of matter, they the reflection of these, you have a sensor, and you can pick up the wave patterns of the Auger electrons and examine surface structure. So it's like having an electron telescope, so to speak, to examine surface structure of metallic crystals. And that's what I was doing at the time for my senior thesis in college. Also involved in that was the shielding. We had to have, when you create an electron beam, there are shielding issues involved, and that all has to be included in the design of the experiment. Okay, well, good. Just a quick note here. I had an experience this past week. I was traveling and came across a family that a number of years ago, I gave them one of my water filters, and this is something I do somewhat regularly if I have a water filter and I'm traveling. First of all, I don't have to carry it all the way back home with me. And second of all, I'm helping some people out who desperately need clean water. But they had been using for this entire period of time a single one of the dome filters. And so very interesting that so I got to drink water out of this water filter that I donated to these people. And still working just fine. They don't have chemicals in their water. It's just a situation where there's dirt, and they use have a natural source of water. And so it's just dirt and other particulate matter from the water source. And that was it. So very good. So years later, the single dome filter is still working, and they had cleaned it occasionally, probably every few months, scrape off or rub off the surface of the gunk that collects on that just micro surface of the water filter element, and back to use again. And so just interesting the way as Siddhartha says, the river returns. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.